On Friday, May 16, 2003, an unknown assailant walked into the Blue Ridge Savings Bank in Greer, South Carolina. Brandishing a .40-caliber Glock handgun, the man initiated a robbery and then herded his three victims, Sylvia Holtzclaw, Ebb Barnes, and Maggie Barnes, into a back storage area, at which time he killed all three execution style. Police had been notified of the robbery due to Sylvia pressing the silent alarm. They arrived within 15 minutes, but were already too late. The suspect was gone, and there was little evidence for them to process. In the blink of an eye, two families were shattered, and the city itself was racked in horror. Who could commit such a violent and senseless crime? Over the past 17 years, investigators have never given up on the case and continue to receive tips to this day. Three prominent suspects have been named over the same time span, though there has never been a solid link to tie any of them to the murders. Sylvia's son, David, continues to this day to keep the crime fresh in people's minds and to plead for information, leading to the arrest and prosecution of his mother's killer. To this day, no one has been charged. This is Trace Evidence, episode 101, The Blue Ridge Savings Triple Murder. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we investigate a horrifying crime from Greer, South Carolina. Before moving into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders, disappearances, and other crimes. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence Podcast. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show, as it is a one-man operation, and you'd like to get some Trace Evidence swag, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information, as well as thorough information on all episodes. To submit case suggestions, you can visit the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Initially, I had a different episode planned for 101. However, during a Facebook live stream, a listener suggested this case, and once I dug into it, I felt I just had to cover it. So this is episode 101, The Blue Ridge Savings Bank Triple Homicide. Greer, South Carolina, sits in both Greenville and Spartanburg counties. Nestled in the Blue Ridge Mountains, Greer is a city known for its scenic beauty and prime location, granting easy access to bigger cities while remaining in more of a small-town mentality, despite its population of 32,000. When it comes to violent crimes, Greer shows an average that is 13% less than the state of South Carolina as a whole. However, on the morning of Friday, May 16, 2003, an incredibly violent and deadly incident occurred which would leave three innocent victims dead. It's a day from which the city of Greer and the state of South Carolina has never fully recovered. It was the first triple homicide in the history of the city. There would be nine murders in Greer in 2003, though only this particular case would not be solved. The Blue Ridge Savings Bank, or Blue Ridge Savings and Loan, was housed in a blue-green trailer converted into a stationary building at 330 East Frontage Road, overlooking Interstate 85, just north of the State 14 exit. Sylvia Holtzclaw was a branch manager there and seemed to enjoy her job working in the little community bank. Sylvia Suddeth Holtzclaw had been a resident of Greer her entire life. She was born to parents Vincent, better known as Bill, and Ruth Garrett Suddeth on September 8, 1946. Throughout her life, Sylvia had established a reputation as being an incredibly kind, thoughtful, and compassionate woman. According to the Greenville News, Sylvia had married her high school sweetheart, having two sons, David and Kevin. Sylvia and her husband divorced while the children were young, but she remained in the same home, which was located just a block over from her parents' home. A member of the First Baptist Church of Greer, Sylvia often volunteered her time and participated in community events. She was the kind of mother who attended all of her son's athletic events, school events, and everything in between. She was a good mother, loving and kind, and she instilled in her children a strong sense of right and wrong, a drive towards respect and kindness. Her son David would later describe his mother, saying, quote, "She was the most kind-hearted, givingest person I've ever known. Loved her community, loved her kids, loved what she does. Her friends would tell you she would talk for hours. She just enjoyed being around people. I don't know of a better person than her." End quote. On that fateful Friday, Sylvia was supposed to be off. Her son David was in town visiting from Tallahassee, Florida, and had planned to spend it with his mother before heading back home. After having lunch with some friends, David received a call from his brother. Unfortunately, Sylvia had agreed to cover a shift for another employee, and she wouldn't be free that afternoon. Kevin asked his brother to run by a local Arby's fast food restaurant and pick up a sandwich for Sylvia, which he did, dropping it off at the bank before heading over to a local mall. Within an hour, Sylvia would be shot alongside two customers at the bank. James Barnes, often called Eb, and his wife Maggie had met one another while attending King College, located in Bristol, Tennessee. Married in 1965, the Barneses would go on to have three children, Dick, Martha, and Elizabeth. Later, they would become grandparents, seeing the birth of six grandchildren. Both had lived lives devoted to education and teaching, and wanted to truly engage students. A Greenville News article reads, quote, "They dressed in period costumes for talks at schools about black work, a kind of embroidery and weaving," end quote. At one point, Maggie had found an old spinning wheel in a great-grandparent's home and decided to take up the challenge. Beyond her interest in embroidery, Maggie also worked for the National Beta Club in Spartanburg, an organization which defines itself as the largest independent nonprofit educational youth organization in America. Eb was very dedicated to education, working as a physics professor for the University of South Carolina, Spartanburg, known today as USC Upstate. Eb was a dedicated professor who, through his own kind and focused methods, earned not only the respect of his students, but also their admiration. Several articles refer to Eb as being a beloved member of the faculty, both by his students and his colleagues. Eb worked at the school for 28 years and spent much of the last seven advising students from the Greenville campus. Jewel Gager, a former student, described Eb by saying, quote, "The wonderful, kind, gray-bearded Santa Claus walked out. He talked to me, and from that moment, I never, never wavered in my determinations," end quote. Kelly Alexander, a resident of Greenville, would add, quote, "He was really kind. He was genuine to the core," end quote. When Eb retired from teaching, now into his early 60s, he and Maggie began making plans. Part of those plans would require the two Boiling Springs residents to transfer some money into their IRA account. Plans were made to pay a visit to the Blue Ridge Savings Bank to get the ball rolling. On the morning of Friday, May 16th, they got in their truck and began the drive towards the bank. When the Barneses arrived at the bank, things weren't exactly operating in typical fashion. Normally, to be able to gain entry, customers would have to be buzzed in by an employee, in this case Sylvia Holtzclaw, who was the only employee on site that day. However, when later interviewed, Sylvia's son David, who had brought her lunch earlier, explained that the locking mechanism wasn't functioning, and as such, the door could be opened from the outside without an employee first granting entrance. This fact would, obviously, become a key detail in the crime which was committed. Just one lapse in the security measures provided by the bank for the protection of both its employees and customers. Sylvia was aware of the issue and had tried to get it fixed. Greer Police Captain Mike Hamby would later explain, quote, "There was a magnetic lock that had been serviced quite a few times. It was having some difficulties, and I believe on that day of the incident, she had made a call to request a repair of the magnetic door. End quote. Sometime between 1 and 1:30 p.m., a gunman would enter the bank in an apparent robbery. At approximately 1:28 p.m., Sylvia hit a panic button to signal local law enforcement that a robbery was taking place. I should note, there seems to be some discrepancies connected to the actual timing of the alarm, with some saying it took place around 1:17 and others saying 1:28. However, what has never been argued is that Greer police would respond to the alarm, arriving 10 to 13 minutes later, and by the time they reached the bank, it was already too late and the suspect had vanished into the afternoon light. Within minutes of the first officer's arrival, several other officers arrived on the scene. According to the Greenville News, three of those officers had previously been students of Professor Barnes. Upon entering the bank, first arriving officers weren't sure what the alarm call was about. There didn't seem to be anything amiss, no signs of a struggle, no indication of anything outside of perhaps a false alarm. Greer police later told reporters that oftentimes when they received an alarm call from a bank or other business, it turned out to be a false alarm. Someone hit the button accidentally, or there was a bug in the security system itself. Searching from one end of the bank to the other, officers couldn't find anyone in the building, which in and of itself was bizarre. However, when they entered a utility room located in the back, they found all three victims, Sylvia, Ebb, and Maggie, shot execution style. While details regarding how many shots had been fired and how many times each victim had been hit have never been revealed, it was later confirmed that the handgun used was a .40 caliber Glock. According to investigators, there was no sign of a struggle, suggesting the gunman had led the three into the back room, perhaps under the belief that he was going to lock them in and leave them alive, but instead, he began firing. Greer detective Dale Arterburn, when asked about the case years later, responded, quote, "I remember it like it was yesterday. It's been like a nightmare in my mind," end quote. For Arterburn, this case was different from many others he had worked on. He knew the Holtzclaw family, and it was a horrible scene for him to walk in on, finding Sylvia amongst the dead. He later explained, quote, "I was heartbroken. We knew this was going to be a very difficult investigation. We knew that from day one," end quote. Difficult was, perhaps, an understatement considering the violent nature of the crime and the utter lack of evidence they had to work with. At the time, there was a VCR-enabled security system running in the bank, but when authorities went to the machine to review what had happened, they found that the tape was missing, possibly taken by the assailant himself. Despite the lack of surveillance footage, authorities were keenly aware that considering the short window of time between the alarm and their arrival, there was a very good chance the killer was still within a 10-mile radius of the bank itself. The crime was confusing to investigators. Despite what often happens in fiction, bank robberies are almost always nonviolent crimes. The perpetrator enters, brandishes a weapon, demands money, and then flees the scene. However, on this Friday in 2003, three individuals were murdered for what seemed to be no apparent reason. Detective Arterburn would later tell reporters, quote, "Big shootouts at banks, that's Hollywood drama. It's a rarity that somebody actually discharges a firearm, let alone somebody gets hurt in a bank robbery," end quote. Police did confirm that money had been taken from the bank. However, they never revealed the total amount, suggesting only that it had been a small amount, certainly not enough to warrant the murder of three innocent people, if such an amount of money even exists. Police quickly secured the scene, calling in a forensics team to sweep through the bank, though their hopes of finding incriminating evidence was a long shot. The bank was a public building, meaning that they would be gathering a large quantity of fingerprints. A sweep for fibers would result in an overwhelming number of results, again, for the same reason. The utility room provided forensic evidence, though it was connected to the victims themselves rather than the perpetrator. Beyond the shell casings connected to a .40 caliber Glock, authorities had little, if anything, to work with. The absence of security footage further complicated issues, however, but when officers canvassed the area, They were able to find both a witness and security footage from two nearby gas stations, which would corroborate and enhance the witness's statements. A witness who had been in the bank earlier that day gave authorities a description of a potential suspect. The man was described as being Caucasian, with blonde hair that showed a touch of gray. He stood between 5 foot 6 inches and 5 foot 8 inches tall, weighed approximately 230 pounds, and was believed to be between the ages of 50 and 53. Overall, the man was described as both clean-cut and portly. Surveillance footage taken from a gas station located at the southbound ramp of I-85 and another gas station located on Frontage Road, the same road as the bank, showed the travels of a red car. At the time, the footage was grainy and difficult to analyze in terms of the specific make and model of the car. The footage did show, though, something which caught the eye of investigators. The vehicle was seen exiting the interstate, then turning left onto Frontage Road, heading in the direction of the bank at approximately 1:24 p.m. In what can only be described as terrible timing, the truck driven by Ebb Barnes was seen turning onto Frontage Road following just 3 minutes behind the red car. Considering the witness had previously seen the alleged suspect in the bank that day, that could suggest that the perpetrator had been casing the bank before choosing to conduct the robbery, which turned into a triple homicide. In hopes of establishing whether or not this red car could be directly linked to the crime, police reenacted the events of that day using established timelines. Captain Hamby told the Greenville News, quote, "We did our best to reenact the travel time and estimated the time it would take inside the bank. It was tight, but it was doable," end quote. When local authorities were unable to enhance the surveillance footage to make it more clear, they were given assistance by both NASA and the General Motors Company, according to thestate.com. Engineers from General Motors confirmed that the car seen in the footage was an Oldsmobile Alero, manufactured between 1999 and 2003. Interestingly, the General Motors Company noted that this particular model of car was most frequently purchased and utilized by car rental companies, a fact that will become important later. Armed with a witness description and confirmation about the vehicle itself, police began the long and tedious process of tracking down all residents who registered ownership of a red Oldsmobile Alero. There were approximately 100 red Aleros registered in the state. While sorting through the list would take time, it would ultimately yield no results, as none of the owners were confirmed to have been in the area at the time this horrible crime took place. When Captain Hamby spoke to reporters, he was asked directly about the motive behind the crime and why he believed the perpetrator had chosen to murder the three victims. Captain Hamby replied, quote, "We think the motive was robbery, and we think the perpetrator lost control of the incident in the bank and panicked, most likely, and determined that he was going to shoot and kill three victims," end quote. Not long after the crime had been committed, and local police realized the breadth of the investigation they were facing, they reached out to the FBI, who would go on to conduct a thorough and focused investigation. Unfortunately, even the FBI, who examined the witness statements, the video footage, and photos of the crime scene, were unable to provide much more information than the Greer police had been able to ascertain on their own. There's a page on the FBI's website which provides two composite sketches of the suspect, in addition to an image of a red Oldsmobile Alero, much like the one seen on surveillance footage. I should note, one article I read dismissed the potential suspect as being a janitor who worked at the bank. However, his description and sketches are still available on multiple sites, including the aforementioned FBI page. In a subsequent article, I read an account from the FBI in which they stated that a local businessman had been investigated as possibly being the man in the sketch, but he had an alibi. An FBI spokesperson told the Greenville News that they kept the sketch up on their website because of, quote, "an abundance of caution that it's not the person we already cleared," end quote. A task force was organized, including more than 40 members of law enforcement, to examine the case. The task force included law enforcement officers from the Greer Police Department, Spartanburg and Greenville Sheriff's Offices, the State Law Enforcement Division, and the FBI. A Greer police training facility was converted into a home base for the task force. As information was gathered, it was then entered into an FBI computer system to keep track and organize. That information was then given to officers to investigate. In the weeks after the killings, police received more than 700 tips. It seemed everyone had an idea of who the suspect could be, from coworkers to neighbors to ex-boyfriends. Though it was a monumental task, investigators looked into every potential suspect and were met only with alibis proving their inability to have committed the crime, let alone to have even been in the area at the time the shootings took place. Once again, it was another dead end for investigators. The FBI did work up a partial profile. Based on the secluded location of the bank, at the end of a dead-end road not frequented by travelers, it was believed that the killer was likely someone local to the area who had knowledge of the bank's location and perhaps its limited staff and security issues. In a contrast to the FBI, Captain Hamby suggested that it could have just as easily been someone who pulled off the interstate, committed the robbery and murders, then hopped right back onto the interstate. The bank was clearly visible from Interstate 85. Investigators became aware of a similar case out of Norfolk, Nebraska. In September of 2002, approximately 8 months before the shootings at the Blue Ridge Savings Bank, four men had robbed a bank and, in the process, murdered five individuals. In that particular case, authorities were able to gather up and arrest the suspects. While it seemed like a case which bore similarities to their own, Greer police and other investigators ultimately were able to rule out those suspects. They had not been in the area at the time, and their bank robbery had been conducted very differently, including wearing stockings to conceal their identities. They also lacked any evidence to suggest the murders in Greer had been conducted by more than one individual, as only a single weapon appeared to have been fired, and neither witnesses nor surveillance footage showed more than one suspect. However, it's important to note, initial reports in the hours after the crime was committed, police did report they were seeking two suspects in the red Alero. Soon, the case began growing colder than it had been at the start. Leads were drying up or being eliminated. The city of Greer, despite its dark memory about the horrible murders, began to move on. This led to frustration from the families who were still eagerly hoping for justice, as well as dead ends for police who wanted desperately to gather more information and break the case. Unfortunately, the more time passed, the less they seemed to have to work with. They had a vehicle to search for, but had never gotten any hits on it. They had a description of a potential suspect, but nothing had ever turned up. They had over 700 tips they tracked down, and still, nothing to further their investigation. With such a lack of evidence, it was an incredibly difficult investigation to work, but police remained focused that it was a solvable case and that someone out there had the information they desperately needed. In July of 2004, 14 months after the murders, the FBI ramped up their efforts to gain tips in the case. More than 25,000 flyers were released nationwide bearing a description of the murders and showing the composite sketch of the potential suspect. In addition to this, a $100,000 reward was offered for information leading to the arrest of a suspect. As was to be expected, more calls came in with potential leads. Although this new flood of information provided the task force with a lot to work with, again, these new tips failed to deliver any legitimate suspects. More than a year into the investigation, authorities received what was, at the time, considered a potential break in the case, but over the ensuing years would become a major source of frustration. Georgia police pulled a man over, a man who was driving a red Oldsmobile Alero. What was interesting about this traffic stop had little to do with speeding or some other moving violation, but instead revolved completely around the car itself. This particular red Alero was stolen. It had been stolen from the Columbia Metro Airport's Avis Car Rental Facility. The Columbia Metro Airport is located 106 miles to the southeast of the Blue Ridge Savings Bank. An important fact to note is the date when the Alero was stolen, May 1st, 2003, just 15 days before the triple murder. The vehicle was being driven by Emerson Wright, also known as Akeem Johnson. Police, though, were unaware of the driver's identity at the time. They later took fingerprints from the vehicle and were able to get a confirmed match. At the time of the traffic stop, Wright was wanted by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation on charges of arson and robbery. According to Nicole Henley, who wrote a 2019 article for Medium.com, in addition to Wright being wanted for robbery, amongst other crimes, his weapon of choice was none other than a Glock handgun. Authorities later confirmed a .40 caliber Glock was found in the vehicle, the same make and caliber as that which was used in the killings. Ballistics tests, however, would show that if Wright had been involved in the triple homicide, he had swapped out guns, as the gun found in the car did not match the shells found at the scene. Unfortunately, while Wright seemed like a very good potential suspect to examine in connection to the triple homicide, he wasn't planning on going along with authorities. At some point during the stop, suggested to be early on, Wright fled from the scene, disappearing into a nearby wooded area. Despite an exhaustive search by authorities, Wright managed to slip through undetected. When Greer police were notified about Wright, they began digging into his background. Among other things, Wright had a record showing previous arrests for aggravated assault, driving under suspension, attempting to elude police, receiving stolen property, and probation violations. Despite their intensive investigation, they couldn't find evidence linking Wright to Greer at the time of the crime. However, they made it clear that Wright was someone they very much wanted to speak with. Unfortunately, he was not located until a year later, on August 2, 2005, 2 years and 3 months after the murders. Emerson Wright was spotted by Georgia police, and this time did not pull over, but instead led authorities on a high-speed chase. Sadly, though, whatever information Wright may have possessed about the murders would die with him. Following the conclusion of the high-speed chase, Wright emerged from his vehicle, produced a handgun, brought it up to his head, and promptly shot himself in front of pursuing police. As Wright bled out on the pavement, any attempts to link him to the triple murder slowly began fading as well. Despite his suicide, police and FBI were still dogged in their attempts to pursue information that could link him to the crimes, with multiple officers telling the media that while he was dead, he was still the best potential suspect they had come across since the beginning of the investigation. In an attempt to try and tie Wright to the crime, or at least to being in Greer at the time the crime was committed, police tried to track down any known associates he had. Unfortunately, very little information could be gleaned from those they spoke with. They visited Wright's home, but again found themselves unable to get much information about his comings and goings during that time. What they did gather suggested that Wright had spent a lot of time by himself during the time the crime was committed, and there were few, if any, people who could confirm or deny his whereabouts at that time. Lieutenant Jimmy Holcomb with the Greer Police told a reporter, quote, "He is a really good suspect. Unfortunately, a lot of the information that could have been gotten we're not able to get because he took his own life," end quote. In 2006, police arrested Linnell Dykes, who later confessed to robbing at least 17 banks over the previous 5 years. Dykes often wore elaborate disguises to conceal his identity during the robberies, including a flowery pink scarf wrapped around his head and face, and in one instance, a pink dress topped off by a large Easter-style hat. While Dykes was looked at as a potential suspect in the murders, none of his previous robberies had resulted in fatalities. While he was clearly a serial bank robber, violence did not seem to connect to his bank robberies, and while he was in possession of a gun, his goals seemed to be more about concealing his identity and escaping with money rather than firing that gun. More than 10 years would pass with information trickling in but leading nowhere. While tips began to thin out over the years, there was always someone bringing new information to authorities. It just never seemed to pan out. Then, in 2016, a major arrest caught the eye of investigators who began wondering if there could be a connection. It's a name you've probably heard before, Todd Christopher Colep, who is now known to have killed 6 victims. His name was splashed all over the headlines in November of 2016 when Caleb Brown was found chained inside of a metal storage container on his property. What may have interested investigators, beyond Colep's obvious penchant for murder, was a crime committed just 6 months after the triple murder. On November 6, 2003, Colep walked into Superbike Motorsports, a motorcycle shop in Chesney, South Carolina. Shortly after entering the business, Colep shot and killed 4 employees: Scott Ponder, the owner, service manager Brian Lucas, mechanic Chris Sherbert, and bookkeeper Beverly Guy were all killed by multiple gunshots. Based on what police knew about the crime, it's believed that Colep entered the business via the back, shooting Sherbert first. He then proceeded deeper inside, shooting Guy in the showroom and shooting Lucas at the front entrance, and then Ponder in the parking lot. It was later alleged that Colep had committed the murders after trying to return a motorcycle to the location, but being turned away. Colep later confessed to the murders and was able to provide details that had not been previously released. Unfortunately, when members of the Spartanburg County Sheriff's Office confronted Colep about the triple murder, he denied any involvement, and as has been said previously, there was so little evidence from the murders that authorities were unable to directly tie him to the Blue Ridge Savings Bank. Yet another possible suspect, but without enough information to proceed. At least in this case, they were actually able to question their suspect. 3 innocent people were murdered by a twisted killer who walked away with very little money. The logic of the killer seems flawed. Why kill all 3 if you'd already gotten what you wanted? Much like in my previous episode on the B-Low killings, there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to any of it. In the second half of the episode, we'll discuss possible motives, potential suspects, and the state of the investigation today. A year after the killings, another armed robbery was attempted at the bank, though this time it did not end violently. In 2011, the bank was officially closed, and while it's been inoperational since that time, the building still stands in the same place, a haunting reminder of the horrible crimes committed there and the needless loss of life. In the aftermath of the murders, the family of Ebb and Maggie Barnes filed a lawsuit against the bank, alleging that their deaths could have been prevented if only the bank had proper security measures in place. They later settled with the bank for an undisclosed sum of money and have been very quiet about the murders in public, the pain too difficult to confront. The family of Sylvia Holtzclaw were unable to file suit due to workers' compensation laws and her status as an employee at the bank. A scholarship was set up in the names of Ebb and Maggie Barnes. Toy drives and other community events have been conducted in Sylvia's honor. For her son, David, however, this will never be over until justice is found and his mother's killer is forced to pay for his crimes. David has worked tirelessly to keep this case in the public eye. He's made a Facebook page, and a billboard was erected near the location of the bank in hopes of drumming up tips and information. In addition to that, David urged Unsolved Mysteries to run a segment on the case, which they did in short form. David also released a YouTube video discussing the case, which I'll include in the show notes and on the website. I'm going to close out the evidence section here by playing a clip from that video of David talking about his mother. I also urge you to share the video to get it more views and to hopefully have it find the eyes and ears of someone who might be able to provide information leading to an arrest.
Mom was 56 years old. She was the type of person that would do anything she could to help people and try to make their lives better. Kids and young people always held a big place in her heart. She volunteered with the church youth group and many community organizations, including the local Cops for Tots program, collecting toys for needy kids at Christmas. Her loss hurts as much today as it did 11 years ago. And not a day goes by that I don't wake up in the morning or go to bed at night thinking about her. There's so many things she's missed over the years, like experiencing my brother's wedding and the birth of her grandson.
The murders of Sylvia Holtzclaw and Ebb and Maggie Barnes is a horribly tragic and brutal incident which rocked the city of Greer and the state of South Carolina. Families were shattered needlessly over what? A couple of $1,000s at most? There's no amount of money where it's ever acceptable to murder anyone. But to senselessly murder three people who, by all indications, went along with the robbery and didn't try to fight back is just terrifying. In most bank robberies, you're taught to just go along with the assailant because, in many cases, they're just looking to grab the cash and go. Sadly, in this case, that is not what happened. Despite their efforts, law enforcement has never been able to pin this crime to anyone. They've had potential suspects, sure, but never anyone they've been able to lock in with any certainty. We'll get to discussing the three suspects a little later, but for now, I wanted to look at the crime itself. Typically, bank robbers aren't prone to shooting people, especially if those people are cooperating with them. To me, there's really only two possibilities of what happened here. Either this guy walked into the bank knowing that he was going to kill Sylvia, and then the Barneses walked in and he decided to kill them also, or this guy completely panicked due to something, and after shooting one, he decided he had to shoot them all to protect himself against being identified. Is there any other way it could have gone down? It was either planned or it was reactionary. Maybe someone said something, maybe he only planned for Sylvia to be there, and when the Barneses showed up, he freaked out. Maybe he was just a twisted psychopath to whom murder didn't matter all that much. It's hard to analyze someone when you know basically nothing about them, but to commit a crime like this, it seems unlikely that this person hadn't committed something like this before or after. I would imagine the psychological impact of murdering three people in cold blood can be incredibly overwhelming, but that's assuming the suspect had a conscience in the first place. Considering what authorities said, little money was taken, so you have to wonder, was the intent robbery in the first place, or was it murder, with money being taken to make it look like a robbery gone wrong? Was the money an afterthought, or was it always part of the plan? That's hard to say. This location bothers me a lot. It wasn't a major bank branch. It wasn't something that a lot of people even knew was there. It was a small bank in a converted trailer on a dead-end road. The dead-end road bothers me a lot because there's only one way in and one way out. A lot of times something like that is enough to dissuade a robber or crime from being committed solely based on the fact that it limits escape options. But not here. This bank was selected, targeted, and then the crime was committed. While I have a great wealth of respect for Captain Hamby, I have to side with the FBI in believing this crime was committed by someone local. Maybe not a Greer resident, but someone from the area who knew that the bank was there. Either someone who passed through the area for work, had relatives nearby, something. Now, on the other hand, you can see the bank from Interstate 85. So it's entirely possible someone passed by there, either once or twice before, or maybe all the time, and decided that it was an easy target. I doubt very much that someone drove by once, saw the bank, and decided to hit it. That just seems entirely too unlikely to me, but sadly in this case, almost anything is possible. I wish I knew the location of the VCR surveillance system to know if this guy simply saw it and decided to take the tape, or he already knew it was there because he had cased the place before. Or maybe they just forgot to put a tape in the system that day. I don't know what the protocol was at the bank. What do you think? So, we've had, throughout the course of this episode, three potential suspects who have been named or discussed by law enforcement and the media. Linnell Dykes, Todd Kolup, and Emerson Wright. We'll begin with who I consider the least likely and work our way towards who I believe is most likely. Following that guideline, the first person I'd like to discuss is Linnell Dykes. Dykes was a serial bank robber who admitted to robbing at least 17 banks in 5 years. Part of his protocol involved wearing eye-catching disguises, which is weird to say the least. Normally, the point of a disguise is to be low-key, to avoid being memorable, and yet this guy was robbing banks in bright pink dresses and flowery headscarves, almost ensuring that people would remember him. Dykes was ordered to undergo a psychological evaluation before he could be tried for charges connected to 15 bank robberies. While the psychologist noted Dykes had depression, exhibited antisocial behavior, and had hypothyroidism, he was ultimately deemed to be competent to stand trial. After a plea deal which had Dykes cop to 5 counts of bank robbery and 2 counts of using a firearm during a violent crime, Dykes found himself sentenced to 41 years in a federal prison with a mandatory 5-year supervised release following the completion of his sentence. My understanding is that he fired a gun during the commission of a carjacking, though no one was shot. Other details about Dykes' bank robberies that are of interest is that he typically robbed banks on Friday afternoons, and the triple homicide took place on a Friday afternoon. There was information that contrasted with the investigation, though. First and foremost, Dykes did not own a red Alero like the one seen in the vicinity of the Blue Ridge Savings Bank, nor was he noted as ever driving one. While the composite sketch is somewhat disputed, I should also note that Dykes is a black male, not a white one, as witnesses described. While Dykes was questioned by authorities about his possible involvement in the triple homicide, no links were ever established. He could certainly be someone who could have committed this crime. He had robbed several banks and businesses in the upstate area. There's just not enough to make a full connection there. And while Dykes brandished a handgun during his robberies, there doesn't appear to be any murders associated with any of his crimes. Dykes is someone you can't rule in and you can't rule out. He knew the upstate, had been through Greer, had a propensity for robbing banks, and owned at least 1 handgun. He fired that gun in the process of a carjacking, though never committed a murder. He had never, in fact, been arrested, charged, or convicted of any violent crimes prior to this. While it's certainly possible he could have been involved, I think out of the 3 suspects named, he's probably the least likely. So we'll move on to the 2nd suspect, Todd Colep. Colep has a notorious history that involves several murders, including a quadruple homicide which took place at a motorcycle shop. Colep's violent career began in 1986 when he abducted and sexually assaulted a 15-year-old girl. Much of those charges were thrown out when Colep agreed to plead guilty to kidnapping. He served time in prison, during which time both a judge and his probation officer argued that he could not be rehabilitated. Colep went on to serve over 14 years, being released in 2001. Following his release, Colep moved down to South Carolina, where his mother lived. He'd go on to build a real estate firm, which made him very wealthy. He would eventually, in 2014, purchase a 100-acre spread of land for $305,000, and then he spent another $80,000 to have a fence placed around the property. But Colep hadn't been crime-free during this time. While he was being recognized as one of the most successful real estate agents in the area, a job he got by lying about his former prison time, he committed the quadruple murder at the motorcycle shop. And then, in August of 2016, Colep abducted Kayla Brown and her boyfriend Charles Carver. Carver was later found shot to death on Colep's property, and Brown was found imprisoned in a storage container. After searching Colep's property further, the remains of Johnny and Megan Coxey were found. In total, Colep is listed as having committed 7 murders and 2 kidnappings and rapes. While Colep confessed to these crimes, he also later wrote to a local newspaper alleging he had more victims that no one had yet linked him to. Colep is certainly a violent criminal, but his interests seem to be targeting people for murder and sexual assault more than anything else. When he killed the 4 victims at the motorcycle shop, he didn't turn around and steal a bunch of money. He had a personal connection to the location and felt that they had wronged him on a deal. That was the impetus for his violent rampage. As far as we know, he never tried to rob any banks, and if he had, it would likely have been one that he had personally conducted business at, and investigators never found anything to tie him to that location. This is a classic case of a violent psychopath who believed himself to be better than others, who believed that the world had wronged him in some way, and who, seemingly, believed he could do whatever he wanted, including killing people for no reason other than his own interests. While I agree that Colep is a sick and violent psychopath who never needs to see the light of day, I can't find much to link him to the bank robbery and triple homicide. Neither could authorities. I do think Colep is capable of this crime, don't get me wrong, but it just doesn't seem to be his style. I think he would have been more likely to walk in and just start shooting. He didn't corral the people at the bike shop, he just opened fire. He doesn't really seem capable of negotiating with people and pretending that he's going to let them live if they just follow his orders. In fact, someone with his superiority complex likely would have looked down on such acts as beneath him, since he's so much better than everyone else. So Colep could have committed this crime, certainly, but he doesn't seem like the most likely of the known suspects. So that leaves Emerson Wright. Wright seems to fit the bill in almost every way possible. He had a history of violent crimes, including robbery. He owned a .40 caliber Glock handgun, not the same one used in the triple homicide, but the same type of gun and the same caliber. This could indicate an interest in that particular firearm, and that he could have disposed of the one used in the murders and then picked up a new one later on down the line because that's the gun he liked. He had a stolen red Oldsmobile Alero, just like the one seen in the surveillance footage taken from the two gas stations near the bank. He had stolen that car from an airport just an hour and a half away from where the bank itself was located. When confronted by authorities, first, Wright fled and escaped. The next time they came upon him, he took his own life. This is obviously someone who wasn't Wright in the first place, but his tendency to commit violence, his familiarity with the upstate area, and his previous crimes seems to suggest that this is a suspect who is most prominent when it comes to the triple homicide. At no point did he ever exhibit any sadness or regret about any of the crimes he committed, and in fact, he continued committing them to his heart's content. Unfortunately, there's just not enough to tie him to this crime, and unless he told someone about it and they come forward with that information, there may never be a way to tie him to this crime. If indeed Emerson Wright was the man responsible for the triple murder, then sadly, the families may forever be robbed of the possibility of justice. There's not a lot to say about Wright beyond that. We don't really know much about him besides his criminal history. Then, like a coward, rather than facing justice, he took his own life before he could be asked any questions. Surely Wright would have known by that time that he was being looked at as a suspect in the triple homicide. It was all over the papers when he fled the first time. Maybe he was willing to face the law for lesser crimes, but when it came to homicide, he wasn't looking to spend the rest of his life behind bars. Sadly, we may never know. There remains the possibility that whoever committed this crime is still out there somewhere, is not one of the suspects that's been on this list, and is living their life the way that they choose, or maybe they're behind bars for another crime. If indeed that is the case, then it can only be hoped that this person will eventually face justice for the atrocities he has committed. I feel a great deal of sadness for the Barnes and Holtzclaw families, and I can only hope that eventually justice will be served, and they can look the monster in his eyes as he is sentenced to spend the rest of his days behind bars. Someone out there listening right now may be in possession of information they don't know is important, that they don't know could break this case wide open. Someone could be in possession of information that's worth $100,000. That person could be you, or your friend, or your relative. Unless someone comes forward or the police get a break in this case, the murders of Sylvia Holtzclaw and Ebb and Maggie Barnes will remain open, unsolved, and growing colder by the day. If you're looking for more information about the Blue Ridge Savings Bank triple homicide, there are many websites and articles available. Unsolved Mysteries did a segment on the case, as did America's Most Wanted, and as always, I will provide my research links in the sources for this episode. If you have any information about the murders of Sylvia Holtzclaw and Ebb and Maggie Barnes, please contact the Greer Police Department at 864-848-2151. You can also contact the FBI Columbia, South Carolina office at 803-551-4200. You can also contact South Carolina Crime Stoppers at 1-888-274-6372. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, tag me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. A lot of you have been contacting me about a potential job opening as a researcher on Trace Evidence. If you're still interested in that job opening, visit trace-evidence.com/careers. There's plenty of information there about what the job would entail, which it'll probably entail more than I've listed there, but it'll give you a general idea. Everything you need to know about how to apply for that position is also listed there, so I look forward to reading your emails. A quick reminder about the contest I'm currently running. If you share episode 100, the investigation into the death of Kurt Cobain, on social media and tag me or Trace Evidence, you receive one entry into the contest with a maximum of 5 entries per account. The winner of the contest will be selected at random, so the more shares, the better your chance of winning. The prize is, of course, my personal copy of episode 100 script with all of my notes and adjustments. The contest ends at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on January 31st, 2020. One final note. Are you planning to attend CrimeCon this year in Orlando? If you are and you haven't yet purchased your ticket, you can use the promo code TRACE2020 to get 10% off today. I'm going to be there on Podcast Row representing Trace Evidence, and I would love to see you there. So, when purchasing your tickets, use promo code TRACE2020, and I look forward to seeing you. I want to thank all of you who have been supportive during these past few weeks that have been difficult for me. I've had some medical issues, which I've discussed on social media, and everyone's support has been greatly appreciated. This is episode 100, which is still mind-blowing to me, but I couldn't have made it this far without all of your amazing support. Speaking of amazing support, it's time to thank our Patreon producers. Special shout out to Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Angie Dodd, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Gerard Lopez Barbosa, Jessica, Laura Dickinson, Linda Halcrow, Nick Mohar Schurz, Megan Cotter, Quinn McBreen, Randy Weiland, Robbie Blue, Tom Archer, and Tracy Woods. If you think your name should be on this list, but it's not, please contact me, as Patreon is often terrible at organizing the lists properly. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Trace Evidence. I'm going to leave you with a promo for another podcast that I think you might enjoy. So, until next time, I hope you'll join me next Tuesday for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Amazing Maine podcast. I'm Scott, your host, and in this podcast, I'm going to talk about everything that makes the northeasternmost state in the USA a special place. We're going to talk about interesting history, great places, distinctive food, fascinating businesses, and a lot of strange cultural things that make Maine a very unique place. I'll be putting up episodes every other week, and I'm really looking forward to sharing my adopted home state with all of you. So if you live in Maine, you've vacationed here, or just curious about the only monosyllabically named state in the Union, then this podcast is for you. Or maybe you just want to hear an out-of-work, middle-aged guy struggle with the technical concepts of podcasting. In that case, this is definitely the podcast for you. So please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platform. Our first episode is already available. The podcast is on Podbean, iTunes, and Google Play Music. Also, please connect with us on social media. Search Facebook for Amazing Maine Podcast and like our page. Look us up on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is @AmazingMainePod. And if you would like to contact me directly, please send me an email to AmazingMainePodcast@gmail.com. I'm looking for ideas, suggestions, and any kind of feedback you may have. Thank you for listening.